Good morning.
All right, now, everybody. Quiet, listen to me. We're going to start a show. Now, some of you people have been with me before. You know it's going to be a tough grind. You're going to dance until your feet fall off. You're not able to stand up any longer. But we're going to have a show.
It's unbelievable, really. The weather outside was the Mary Lou storm.
There isn't enough space on the tallymen's sheets here to count all of the Sinn Féin votes that are spilling out of the boxes.
I have a feeling we're going to be doing a lot of sums over the next few days.
Radical realignment, probably the most stunning opinion poll in the history of the state.
This is democracy in action. You must have missed it when you were in Moscow.
The Labour Party here, it's not good reading for them. They're not in good health.
Home and hosed, are you sorry you didn't bring someone with you?
Well, if we had a crystal ball, I think we probably would have stood more candidates, but we didn't.
The Sinn Féin people remind me a bit of the Liverpool fans. They know they have it won, but they just don't want to get too excited yet.
Why did Brexit not resonate with voters, do you think?
Yeah. Not to have a Fine Gael TD in Cork South West is quite something. I mean, I remember talking to a Fianna Fáil down there a few years ago who said, Asha, they're still voting for Collins around
no,
here.
No, honestly, and it's like
listening to Fine Gael at the moment, actually. It's like someone has said to them, listen, you've got a body odour problem, and they're still going around today saying, have you smelt my perfume? It's amazing.
And was that the point at which you pulled out the accordion?
No, I can pull out the accordion at any time. The accordion didn't re-elect me at all. But
this is probably the first time in the history of the state, in the history of Ireland, that a Sinn Féin TD or MP has represented every single county in Ireland. And I think this is probably the most significant electoral shift in Republican terms since the election of Bobby Sands in 1981.
The people have spoken.
In terms of party organisations, wouldn't it be a bit like asking siblings to get married?
That's what people want. That's what they voted for. Keep them two out, was what they said to us on every doorstep.
At some stage, people on the left have to put down their megaphone and realise that if they want to get into government, they have to come up with some proposals.
Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin in a coalition together.
Mary Wilson, great broadcaster, terrible matchmaker.
You know, would a second election be a huge different result? Depends how soon it was called.
Gary, I'm going to stop you right there.
And that is just a little of how it went down. Studio 10 here was a revolving door of analysts and pundits, crestfallen politicians out of a job and putting on a brave face, and triumphant new TDs taking their seats at the table, often for the first time. And whatever your political leanings, it was rather addictive stuff. And the word of the election? Change. Ostensibly a fairly neutral term, but coming with such force, well, do feel free to play change bingo as you listen. However, not everyone was pleased with the result. Monday saw a small break in the count to bring us live line, but there was no respite from the national conversation. Marion is Team Leo all the way, and Nicola voted Sinn Féin number one, and candidates on the left for everything else, or as she puts it,
anything whatsoever to get Fine Gael and to get Leo Varadkar out of government, because they're the ones with blood on their hands.
That's rubbish.
You be quiet while
that
I speak.
Is
no, hang on.
That
I'll moderate it.
Nick. Joe, you cannot let her say that.
I'm going to find out what Nicola... Nicola, what do you mean by that? Please, now, don't.
Please be quiet while I'm speaking.
But do not accuse an innocent man of blood on his hands when there's somebody up in Mrs. Quinn and all these people.
Okay, Nicola, your point, please. Go ahead.
Joe, can you get her to calm down?
I will not calm down. I will tell the truth. And you are telling lies. I will tell the truth. You
tell me what I can speak.
Okay, Mary, Nick, 1 minute, Nicola. Go ahead and then
I'll... All right, I'll let her. Listen, you might as
well. Go ahead, Nicola.
Right, what was the question, Joe? I've forgotten she's so high as a kite.
Oh, my God. It's very important.
Okay, say with us.
Be quiet, Marion.
Say with us. Let everyone calm down for 5 minutes.
Ooh, now perhaps the acrimony in the exchanges mirrored the national conversation, but it wasn't pleasant. Nicola said she'd voted Sinn Féin to get, yes, you've guessed it, change. She had worked with people in disadvantaged areas and highlighted the number of children who are homeless.
What
you
do you
see, over 20 years. So I've seen the way it's disintegrated, the way it's gotten so worse. It's horrific.
It's almost like
and
as
Leo
if we are
and
not Simon. Human
and Nicola, what do you
Leo
think of...
Leo and Simon and
wonderful
Owen and the rest of them, they've couldn't care less. They do care.
Do you care?
Please be quiet, Marion.
We all care very
please
much.
Please be quiet, Marion.
We do care, yeah.
Do that. You mustn't decide that we are not human beings and that we don't care, that you're the only caring person.
I care about everyone. The reality is, one of the reasons I joined Fine Gael, one of the reasons I joined the Justice Society, is the country is really divided.
Last 1 minute of this text poll. Let me finish. 51551.
Liveline on Monday, and I'm not sure if you can hear Joe over all that, a rare occurrence, let's face it, but he was calling for texters to get in touch for the polls the programme ran all week to gauge the temperature of the nation. Here, in short, are the results of the Liveline Coalition text polls.
The preference at the minute is 52% are saying yes to Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin, 46% are saying yes to Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, and 31% are saying yes to Fine Gael and Sinn Féin. So forget about that option. So, but the other two options are fairly... It's all to play for at this stage.
But could any of the parties come together and reach the magic figure of 80? Well, on Wednesday, Drive Time's Fergal Keane went down to Leinster House with his coalition abacus.
What they're really hoping for is a left-wing minority government. But no matter how you look at it, it's going to be very difficult for Sinn Féin to form a government one way or another without one of the other two big blocs, Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael. The numbers just aren't there. They could probably muster 60 to 65 relatively easily of those people who might then stay the course, but it would be hugely unstable. It'd be at the mercy every single day of their political enemies, and they would be relying on the threat of going for an election, blaming the other parties for not giving this new type of government a chance. So really holding the threat of an election to keep them in power.
Fergal Keane on Drive Time. Earlier that same day, Sean O'Rourke spoke to various politicians about how the parties might sashay and tango to make up a government. But the programme itself had something of a tricky start.
Getting ready for coronavirus, slip of the tongue there.
Oh, a fiercely highbrow slip of the tongue, though. But fatigue was setting in.
Louise O'Reilly, as I say, you are a member of the Fine Gael negotiating team.
I'm a member of the Sinn Féin negotiating team, Sean.
Sorry, I beg your pardon.
It's been a very long weekend.
It's been, yeah, I think I'll reach for the excuse, you know, sort of. It's been a very tiring time and all the rest of it, you know. We say things we don't intend saying. Thank you for that clarification.
A long week indeed. But it was when Sean spoke to Fianna Fáil's Charney McConnell Ogue that tempers really started to fray.
What do you think about the idea of Fianna Fáil working with Sinn Féin or facilitating a Sinn Féin-led government?
Well, I think, first of all, Sean, we are glad of the fact that we are the largest party, but very narrowly. But we very much reflect on the election result and on the public, the message the public give. Micheál Martin is now will be over the next short number of days meeting with other smaller parties, as we committed to before the election. The party will also be meeting tomorrow as a parliamentary party to assess the outcome of the election campaign. But I think what's also clear from the election campaign, particularly in relation to Sinn Féin, which was your question there, Mary Lou had indicated that, you know, the worst thing that could happen in the country would be for them to go in with Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael. Throughout, as Breed pointed out there, throughout the election campaign, there was a concerted effort to ensure that votes would transfer left to the left. If you look at Breed's own constituency, where there's no Fianna Fáil representative there, which Catherine Arda narrowly missed out, unfortunately, a very fine representative, and no Fine Gael either. You had a situation where Breed and Joan Collins got elected by.
I know we've done all the constituency analysis, so we're just wondering what happens now.
And Mary Lou has indicated now that she wants to speak with those parties who, and before the election was there, indicated that that's what they'd be doing. So that is now, I mean, she should take up that mantle in terms of seeking to do that and to assess what the possibilities are in that regard, with regard to following through on the vote that they sought. From a Fianna Fáil point of view, now we'll be meeting tomorrow, and Micheál Martin will also be meeting with some other parties, and he's made contact with them, and certainly we'll be looking to engage in a constructive manner in terms of how the country might go forward and, you know, the key issues. is about
Look, this
about
is all waffle, Charlie. Can I just cut through it for a minute? What is Fianna Fáil's view about working with Fine Gael or working with Sinn Féin at this stage?
Ooh, touchy enough, and it didn't get too much better for either man.
Well, as I've outlined to you, Sean, Sinn Féin have outlined that they wish to put together an alternative coalition.
We know that, but what I'm asking you about is Fianna Fáil's position.
And Fianna, from our point of view, Sean, we'll be meeting tomorrow as a party.
I know, you've said that twice already, Charlie. Now, I mean, look,
clearly, Sean, I mean, coming from the election campaign, you know, we are narrowly the largest party. We had indicated...
I know, you've said that already as well.
We had indicated we would speak to other smaller parties. We do want to deliver an outcome which actually addresses issues such as health and housing and brings about radical change in regard to the delivery of those. And, you know, we will engage constructively over the coming period now in relation to how those issues can be addressed.
OK, can I ask you, are you prepared to engage constructively with Sinn Féin? And if so, how?
Well, Sinn Féin have outlined where they stand. And, I mean, there is a responsibility on them.
Oh, no, hold on, sorry. We're asking you... Now, hang on. The last time I checked, you were representing Fianna Fáil. Louisa Riley is well able to represent Sinn Féin and she's sitting 4 feet from me across the table. What I want to know from you, if you're prepared to tell me, are you holding the line that was repeatedly given to us before the vote and before the votes were counted, that there was no way you would work with Sinn Féin?
Well, there's very serious concern there, Sean, in relation to the impact that Sinn Féin policy would have on the economy, in relation to the additional taxes that could make the country and the economy a cold place for enterprise. And also, for example, you know, we've seen issues in the last couple of days in relation to the comments made by David Cullinan, which are very concerning for people. But from a Fianna Fáil point of view, we are narrowly the largest party.
Okay, you've said that about four times now. Louisa Riley, can you translate any of that?
A rather exasperated Sean O'Rourke on Wednesday, but in fairness, this is how we ended the item.
Apologies for my impatience, which probably surfaced at a few moments in those conversations.
Sean O'Rourke on Wednesday. But as the week wore on, the disco dancing gyrations of all the parties were beginning to get on everyone's nerves. Here's a little flavour of some of the moves on the dance floor. First to step out, Fianna Fáil's Michael McGrath.
Do the hustle! Okay, would that be a scenario that would be appealing to Fianna Fáil?
That Fine Gael would provide confidence and supply from opposition.
Reverse confidence and supply to what we had over the last few years.
Look, I think it has to be explored. There are no easy options here.
But is a coalition with Fine Gael and yourselves and the Greens and others, is that something that Fianna Fáil discussed today and something that you will consider?
There was absolutely no decision taken question whatsoever today. We are in a process here.
Ona Brin, Sinn Féin, to the dance floor.
Delivers real change.
Can I just go back to what I asked you there at the beginning? Having written to Fianna Fáil earlier on during the week, will your party leader write to Fine Gael now?
That's a decision Mary Lou will make in the coming days.
But what do you think will happen? Do you think she will? Do you think she should?
We have said from the outset we will talk to all parties and that includes Fine Gael. But what's really important in this...
Absolutely. If we could concentrate on that. And you're prepared at this stage to do that with either Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael. Do you have a preference?
The preference is for what's in the programme.
As you've already acknowledged, and apologies for interrupting you, you're going to need one of the two big parties to do that. Do you have a preference for which of those parties do you think will be able to deliver the programme that you want to deliver?
No, because in some senses... Neither of those parties have ever delivered the kind of programme we're talking about. The thing is what's in the programme.
Does it matter to you which one of them it is then?
What matters is the number of houses we can build, the number of doctors and nurses
and
we can employ.
And we've been through that, yes.
If we can get the
pension.
But
you're going to need parties
to
help you with that and we're trying to work out how you're going to do that.
And the best way to do that is for all parties to be responsible.
And finally, Fine Gael's Heather Humphreys in her jumpsuit.
Could I concentrate on Fine Gael's position with you, if that's okay? You've ruled out going into government with Sinn Féin. You've ruled out talking to Sinn Féin. I think I can gather from what you've said to me that you are at least open to talking to Fianna Fáil when that prospect arises. Are you open to going into government with Fianna Fáil?
Well, we haven't. Our parliamentary party hasn't met yet. I don't want to preempt the outcome of that.
You've already ruled out going into government with Sinn Féin.
Yeah, that was clear. Yes.
Are you ruling out going into government with Fianna Fáil?
Yeah. Well, I don't have the mandate to be making decisions.
But
this
you've
morning.
Told me that you've already ruled out Sinn Féin. I'm just simply asking you, is that the case with Fianna Fáil too?
Yeah, just to be clear here. just to be very, very clear, we ruled out going into a coalition or into government with Sinn Féin prior to the election.
Yes.
That was very clear.
Yes.
And that hasn't changed.
And you've made that point. And your position in relation to Fianna Fáil, are you ruling out going into government with Fianna Fáil?
Well, I don't, as I said to you, I don't have a mandate to be making decisions this morning.
So you're not ruling it out, is that fair?
No. Well, the Taoiseach said that he would talk to all other parties bar Sinn Féin. But what I'm saying to you is a parliamentary party hasn't even met.
A little sweaty of brow after all that, but rest assured there'll be a whole lot more dancing before the lights come up. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Now, while you might be forgiven for thinking that the whole of radio was devoted to the election, that's not strictly true. Mostly, mind you, but there were glimpses of life on the outside on offer. Eimear Noone made history when she became the first woman to conduct the orchestra at the Oscars ceremony. She talked to Ray Darcy when she had just hopped off the plane back from LA.
How close were you to the stars?
Oh, very. I was sitting behind Quentin Tarantino and I was in about the fourth or the fifth row. So, and during the performance, I was in a raised pit. So there was just some plexiglass between me and Scarlett Johansson and Adam Driver and the whole front row. So it was just, you know, right there, you know.
here's a silly question for you. Do they smell different?
Definitely. I would say 100%, yeah.
They smell rich.
They smell like God. Yeah, definitely.
So how were the nerves then?
Do you know, I wasn't nervous. I was very excited and, you know, we were well rehearsed. I know that orchestra well, and you know, I mean, there's a certain point where you go, yes, live performance is unpredictable, but be that as it may, we're ready.
Yeah.
And at that point I was like, come on, can we have a, let's go.
And who introduced you?
Oh my God, it was three superheroes, Sigourney Weaver, Gal Gadot and Brie Larson. I mean, I couldn't believe it. Wonder Woman and Captain Marvel and Sigourney Weaver, you know, it's just
And that. Was a lot made of the fact that you were the first woman to conduct at the Oscars?
It was a lot made of it, and I was surprised. I mean, God, the way I was treated by the Academy was amazing. The way I was treated by the producers. I had women all night coming up to me, and men as well, of course, but so many women just coming up and giving me hugs.
And for Eimear, it was a case of, if you can see it, you can be it.
I just wanted little Irish girls to see it.
Yeah.
And just go, you know, yay, I can do that. That was in my heart and my mind.
Conductor Eimear Noone with Ray. The online world was key to the radicalising of a Texan woman named Colleen, who became known as Jihad Jane, the subject of a documentary by Kieran Cassidy. She had met various people online, including an American woman named Jamie and a man known as Black Flag, who invited them both to his apartment in Waterford, and together they had plotted a terror attack. Kieran Cassidy spoke to Ian Tuberty about what had happened.
She arrived into the apartment and Jamie was there, the other American woman.
Yes.
And she talked online with the American woman, but she didn't realise she was coming over as well. So all of a sudden, there's two American women in this guy who's calling himself Black Flag's apartment in Waterford.
And how old was Black Flag, or what's his background, or what did he...
Ali Sharaf Dimash was Algerian who'd spent a long time living in France, then moved to Ireland. And I think he'd worked in Cork. All during those stages, he wasn't radicalised. He was married to an Irish woman, and she says it just started happening over time, and then she broke up with him, and then he kind of started living in Waterford. And then he started going online. And then he started communicating with these women.
Okay, so he gets them over to the flat, and now that you suddenly have a sort of like a weird Mexican standoff with two Americans,
yeah,
and this other head looking at each other going, what's next?
They had a lot of plans online. They talked a lot. They had seen each other's avatars, but they'd never met each other.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, reality came crashing in when they were all sitting in this one bedroom apartment in the centre of Waterford. And I think like one of the first things Dimash was looking for was like the ATM card of Jamie, because he didn't have any money. So like the reality of the camp, the reality of what he was kind of proposing. Now, it's mad that they were coming over and this is maybe what they were expecting.
Yes.
But then the reality kind of hit them as well.
So sticking with the guy in Waterford who'd promised training camp and there was talk that they would be assassinating the cartoonist in Sweden who put the prophet's head on a...
On a dog,
on a dog's head. And they said, we want you to go and kill him. So where was the training camp in the day shift? Like what came of all of this?
The thing about it was, I think from Colleen's perspective, she saw none of it. She experienced, like, it never really got off the ground. Lars Vilks didn't come up and mention anymore. And
the cartoonist.
Yeah. And she started like kind of losing interest.
So tiring of the whole affair, she wants to go home and decides to come clean to the FBI.
She went up to the Garda station in Waterford and she looked for the FBI department. And then there was no FBI department. So the guy got confused, asked, you know, what she was looking for. And then she just headed off.
And although nothing had ever actually happened, when Jihad Jane did get in touch with the FBI, she got 8 years in prison and quite a lot of notoriety. However, Kieran was keen to point out that the seeds for radicalisation had been sown in damage, isolation and rather lax internet controls.
Colleen had this incredibly bleak, incredibly tough background and a very, very damaged person. Sexual abuse, you know, from her father when she was 8 years of age. Then she was a child prostitute from 13. And then she just went into like heavy drink and drugs during that period of time. And I think like the other people involved had kind of very similar tough backgrounds. And they all drifted. Yeah, it's a very online story. And I think one of the things that really struck me about the story going through it was nobody here went near a mosque. Nobody, you know, like there was no radical preacher. Yeah. This was all on YouTube. And what it was is just at this period of time, now they've cleaned up concerning, like say, jihadi videos, but you can still get a lot of white nationalist videos online. But they were very readily available. And then people could go in and just communicate with each other on the message board. So you could put a comment up on it and then somebody would go in and reply to yours. So yeah, there was very damaged, very lost, very lonely people communicating with each other from different parts of the world.
Jihad Jane documentary maker Kieran Cassidy with Ryan. And on Monday evening, Irina brought us an interview with Emer McBride about her new novel, Strange Hotel. Sean Rocks asked her about the protagonist in her novel.
I read, Emer, where you talked about all your books at their heart, loneliness is the thing. So this woman and the lonely and strange hotel rooms that she's visiting, is loneliness at the heart of her story?
Yeah, I think so. I suppose it's there are a lot of things. There's the idea of grief. So literally loneliness for someone, but also a kind of loneliness that I think comes to a lot of women as they get older, a sense of kind of isolation, of being set aside from the world, of not being so important to it. And also someone who's trying to stay away from painful memories, and that kind of creates a vacuum inside as well.
Yeah, quite early on, there's an interesting quote about when my head is at rest. I haven't got the exact quote. When my head is at rest, that's bliss. When there aren't monkeys jumping around inside, I guess she's telling us.
Yeah, absolutely. She's someone who's very tortured by her own thought process, you know, and aware constantly of kind of second guessing herself, of criticising herself, of almost viewing herself from the outside and thinking, oh, well, I shouldn't be doing that. And, you know, doing simple things like she orders some wine and then like the critic in the head is like, don't be ordering the wine and then don't be getting drunk and don't do this. And how exhausting that is, to be constantly kind of assessing yourself and judging yourself, and how she tries to shut it off.
And McBride's previous books had featured a teenage girl and a woman in her 20s. Now with Strange Hotel, we have someone in their 40s. And Sean asked her, why this character? Why now?
Was it a very conscious decision to say, right, I've done the child, I've done the 20s. Now I want to go into something closer to my own age, perhaps?
Oh, yeah, I thought, God almighty, I'm 43. It's time that I, you know, and I'm always moaning about how women of my age aren't represented. And so, of course, then I should do something about that. And also, I was very interested in my other characters when I was writing them, but also, you know, 18-year-olds are not that interesting to me now. I'm much more interested in what women are as they get older, how they think, the things that drive them crazy and stuff that they have to deal with. And, you know, she does all of that where she's just like, God, I'm so sick of people making assumptions that, oh, you should have had a baby, you shouldn't have had a baby, you should be with someone, you shouldn't be with someone, and that I spend my time worrying about aging, and, you know, and she doesn't. And she really objects to the fact that she's supposed to waste her time and her fine brain worrying about, you know, whether her stomach sticks out or not. Yeah.
Mind you, she doesn't need anybody else to criticise her or to make her think about agonising. She agonises over, I don't know if agonising is the right word, but she certainly mulls over everything, doesn't she?
Oh, I mean, she is her own worst enemy. Mm. She torments herself. And again, I think, well, that's an experience that I would share as a woman of a similar age, where I feel like, and you know, and I'm also intelligent, and I'm also have had a lot of interesting experiences in my life, and all of those kind of feed in. I mean, the more you've thought, the more you've done, the more problems you can create for yourself in your own head. Yeah. You know, it creates some shortcuts, but also, you know, you can really kind of devour yourself.
Yeah. But you're not talking about autobiographical details
in the novel. I mean, it's a novel. It's not a memoir, as with all the books. Yeah. But I think it's ironic how much criticism women have to put up with, and really how much we put ourselves through.
Emma McBride with Sean Rocks on Arena on Monday. Yesterday, Shea Byrne had a competition to find the missing word in songs sung by singers who are, well, not singers. This is Darren Frehill, and he's in the shower.
Well, I took a stroll on the old long walk of a day, ay-ay-ay-ay. I met a little girl and we stopped to talk of a fine soft day, ay-ay. And I asked you, what a fella's to do? 'Cause her hair was black and her eyes were blue. And I knew right then I'd be taking a whirl round the Salt Hill prom with the Galway girl. You!
What a way to end the week. Words fail me. Darren Frehill with the Galway girl. What is the missing? What is the... Normally we play that twice. I'm not sure I can handle it.
I don't think any of us can. Back in a bit. Welcome back. I hope you woke up this morning on a bed of rose petals, smelling of eau de mour and, well, general good times, because yesterday was Valentine's Day. On Countrywide, Brenda Donoghue spoke to Willie and Cheryl, who run a business together. They also married, eventually, more and on, but this is how it started.
Cheryl, did you always like him, if you know what I mean?
I did, actually. I was around 16 at the time. It was the first time I actually met Willie, would you believe? And Willie was working on a house beside a friend of mine's. And I remember just thinking, God, that lad is a good-looking chap. And I went and got all dollied up. I got makeup on and changed my outfit and the whole lot and sat on the wall staring at him. And lo and behold, I didn't realise it was Willie till I was a year in the company. Both of us were working. Yeah. And Willie was like, oh yeah, I know, I remember building the house. And I was like, no, there was a really good looking guy in the house building it. And he was like, that's me. And I was like, no, he was really good looking.
But they did get together, and Willie wanted to get married. He really wanted to get married.
I asked her every single day, maybe two times a day, for what, 2-3 years?
1,400 times, yeah. To marry.
Yeah, Cheryl got the numbers. And then, yeah, so 1,400 times. And then the day before I proposed, we were away on holidays in California in Yosemite. And I had asked her, and she used to, some days she wouldn't take it lightly, and she'd get a little bit annoyed with me. She'd be like, you're never going to marry me.
I was so annoyed that day. I was like, oh, one of these days, Willie.
Yeah. So I said to her, I promise you, tomorrow will be the last day I'll ever ask you. So we went to Yosemite that day and we spent the day. And at 4 o'clock California time, which is midnight in Ireland for New Year's, I got down and Cheryl was looking at, there was a beautiful waterfall in the background and we were on this beautiful bridge and there was deers and stuff crossing the river. And I turned around and I called Cheryl and she turned around and I was on my knee and I said, I told you today will be the last day I ask you to marry me. And she said,
oh,
yes.
Oh, so sweet.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
And it was. And I did say yes that time.
Yeah, yeah. 1,400 times later. Yeah.
So I might as well put you out your misery.
Yeah.
Asher, go on. We may as well. A deeply Irish proposal there. That was Willie and Cheryl on Countrywide. But these days, getting gussied up and sitting on the wall has translated to uploaded photos and screen swiping with online dating. What price love, you might ask? Well, it turns out over €1 million last year with 75 cases of what's called romance fraud. Here's Detective Chief Superintendent Pat Lorden on the News at One.
What would be the giveaway signs or the telltale signs that, you know, this fantastic person you're clicking with online, that they might be a fraudster?
It's quite difficult because we have interviewed one of these fraudsters ourselves, and they're very well prepared. They have a booklet literally in front of them with the right answers to the questions that you will ask. They will have photographs that they can send you of them on a beach or reading a book or going hiking. It doesn't matter. They're very well prepared, and I can see why people would fall for them online. They're not just dropping in for an hour's work. This is their full-time job, to target people online. I suppose the giveaway for us is when, number one, they ask for money, and number two, if you come up with an excuse for not sending money, they try and put pressure on you that, look, you will never meet me, you will never get to see me unless you send me this money. And oftentimes the amount of money can be very small. We've seen many cases where it's only 500 or 600 euros to pay for a flight for them to come to see you. Or if you are going to go to see them in another country, that they want you to send over the cost of accommodation. They're going to pre-book a gorgeous hotel for you.
Oh, it will be all too easy to be fooled, I suspect. Heart open, wallet closed seems to be the message there. The new strain of the coronavirus has been given an official title. This is the Director General of the World Health Organization, Dr. Tedros.
We now have a name for the disease, and it is COVID-19. We had to find a name that did not refer to a geographical location, an animal, an individual or group of people, and which is also pronounceable and related to the disease. Having a name matters to prevent the use of other names that can be inaccurate or stigmatizing.
COVID-19 it is then. And a change in how cases were diagnosed resulted in a sharp increase in the number of people deemed to both have the virus and have died from it. On Thursday's Morning Ireland, Rachel English spoke to Eva Ramelou in Shanghai, who works for the Dutch newspaper Trouw, and she asked her about the sacking of high-level officials in China.
It wasn't very unexpected because they were to blame for this virus being able to spread. They sounded the alarm way too late, allowing for at least 5 million people to leave Wuhan, some of them infected, to go on celebrate New Year's with their families and then infect more people.
Is there confidence that China is starting to overcome its problems, both in terms of how they communicate the severity of the virus and indeed in the general effort to tackle it?
Well, in terms of communication, that's still a big question. There's a lot of people unhappy about the way that they receive information, or better to say, that they don't receive any information. The government wants to be absolutely sure for every bit of information that it communicates to its people. So often they wait a long time, and a lot of bad things happen while they are waiting. Now, on the other hand, many people are very confident that the measures that are being put in place are effective. The measures are quite extreme. Now, at least 80 cities are locked down. No one goes in or out of them. I went to see some of those roadblocks myself last week. People have full confidence and they're just biding their time.
From Morning Ireland on Thursday. Psychologist Dr. Sabina Brennan came into Sean O'Rourke to talk about dementia. And if you were born any time before 1990, yes, 1990, listen up.
Around the age of 30, when our brain starts to shrink in size, that's around the time when we stop doing or decrease the amount of time we spend doing a lot of the things that actually boost brain health and help build that resilience, like exercise, like challenging your brain, education, engaging in mentally stimulating activities, doing new things.
However, there are lots of ways in which we can help ourselves and keep our brains in shape, so all is not lost.
We think that 30% of all cases of Alzheimer's disease are attributable to 7 modifiable risk factors, so things we can do something about. And those in turn are really the things that you engage in to keep your brain healthy. So, for example, low levels of education or mental stimulation increase your risk. So you need to stay engaged. Lifelong learning is brilliant. It doesn't have to be academic. It can be anything. Learn a new instrument, you know, anything that appeals to you. Low levels of physical activity increase your risk. So get physically active. And that includes muscle strength. We don't lose our muscles because we age. We lose our muscles because we stop using them. And that's also...
You're talking about our physical muscles.
I'm
there,
talking
yes.
about our physical muscles. I'm not talking about our brain. I'm also talking about physical exercise. Aerobic exercise is brilliant. Your brain needs nutrients and oxygen. Exercise also releases a hormone called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, but I just call it Miracle-Gro for the brain. So basically it releases this so that it makes it easier for new connections to grow in your brain and new neurons to develop. And that's what you want. Think activity, attitude and lifestyle. Get physically active, stay mentally active, stay socially engaged. That is critical. That's why social isolation and loneliness are a problem. Attitude matters. People who have a negative attitude to aging, they become less sharp as they older. And if they're reminded about memory loss, they perform more poorly on memory tasks. So get rid of those, you know, oh, I'm having a senior moment sort of thing. Don't say them. They're self-fulfilling prophecies. Also being positive and smiling, laughter, brilliant, absolutely brilliant for your brain health. Managing stress is critical. Making sure that you get enough sleep, because when you sleep at night, your brain has a job of work to do. And one of those jobs is clearing out the toxins that are involved in Alzheimer's disease. Managing sleep.
Activity, attitude and lifestyle. That was Dr. Sabina Brennan with Sean. On Saturday, Brendan O'Connor spoke to John Banville about his new book, The Secret Guests. It's set during World War II and imagines what might happen if Princesses Elizabeth and Margaret had been spirited away to a crumbling castle in Ireland for safekeeping. So Brendan wondered if Banville was a fan of the royals.
Oh, yes. I mean, I think they're pretty good value. They keep the English together. And as we know, the English are very strange people. They seem perfectly sane and calm and self-possessed until they lose the run of themselves. I don't see why we were so surprised by the Brexit hysteria. All you had to do is look back to Princess Diana's death when the country went completely crackers. I think they live repressed lives. I have great admiration for them. They're liberal people, at least used to be. But they probably are too repressed. They also have this mad notion themselves as the exception. You know, they're the people who are exception from everybody else in the world. When they realise that they've become a vassal state of Donald Trump's America in the next year or two, they may change that opinion. But I think the royal family is good value.
Yeah, I saw
it. It gives endless entertainment. Look,
absolutely. You wrote last week that the royals keep England going in its fantasy. Is this its fantasy of exceptionalism?
Yes, well, I mean, nobody puts on a better show.
Yeah.
Better show of imperialism. But the great secret of the royal family is that they can do pageantry. They can do the imperium. But they're also a perfectly ordinary middle-class family with ordinary middle-class troubles. That's their great attraction. Mm. Everybody can identify with them. And then on high days and holy days, there would be this grand show. And the golden carriage will be brought out and Fantasyland is there for a day.
Ooh, feels slightly damning with faint praise there. That was John Banville with Brendan O'Connor on Saturday. On Thursday, Ray Darcy spoke to Brendan O'Carroll and Jennifer Gibney. And they're mad for the politics.
Politics, and particularly elections, are your porn.
Oh, big time, yeah. Definitely absolutely. Porn.
The Dewey.
Yeah, absolutely.
But of course, this political habit was bred in the bone. His mother, Maureen, had been elected to the Dáil as a Labour TD in 1954.
Her deposit at the time was 10 quid. She at the polling station all day. My dad, he was a cabinet maker and just didn't get involved. But he loaned her the tenner to pay the deposit. She came out in the polling stations once they closed, and he had a basin of water with Epsom salt in it for her to soak her feet. And as she was making her a cup of tea, she said, Jerry, I think I've lost the deposit. I don't know how I'm going to pay it back. And he said, I'll think of something. And the next day, he was working on a roll top desk, doing a bit of hand carving on it. Forgot all about the election and the count. And it was his brother said to him, any news of Maureen? And he went, oh my God. So he got his motorbike, went around to Bolton Street College. A guard on the door said, you know, have you got a pass? You can't get in. So he said, my wife is running. And he said, what's her name? He said, Maureen O'Carroll. He said, hang on there. And he went in and he came back out. And he said, have you got a suit? He said, yeah. He said, well, you better go home and put it on. She's going to be elected in about an hour.
Yay!
Amazing.
So what then was his take on the election?
The truth is this. Change is wanted. Change is demanded. And the public has spoken. Apparently, there's going to be an election before Christmas.
Oh, wash your mouth out, sir. That was Brendan O'Carroll with Ray Darcy on Thursday. Last weekend, the death was announced of journalist and broadcaster Keelan Shanley at the age of 51. She'd worked in television and radio, and Gavin Jennings remembered her on Sunday's Morning Ireland just before they started their election coverage.
I just want to take a moment to remember our colleague and our much-loved friend Keelan Shanley, who we lost yesterday. Morning Ireland had the honour and the privilege to have Keelan as a presenter, and when we did the special election programme on the morning of the results in 2016, it was Keelan and Cottle who presented. She loved elections and would really have enjoyed today. She was a brilliant journalist. She was a scientist, curious and probing. She was sharp, bright and very, very clever. Listeners and viewers were struck by her gorgeous voice and her warmth, which gave you a window into the Keelan that we knew and enjoyed away from the microphone. She was kind. She was wickedly funny. She was very cool. And every day that she came to work, that she was here, was a better day to be at work. On a personal level, I'll miss our Lucy Mutual Appreciation Society. We're both parents to a Lucy. Our thoughts are with Keelan's Lucy, her brother Ben, and her husband Connor today. We loved her too, and we'll miss her hugely.
Gavin Jennings on the late Keelan Shanley. Well, we are almost at a finish here on Playback, and as Storm Ciara raged and blew over the ballot boxes, the lyric feature last Sunday was a truly beautiful piece of radio. From Regan Hutchins, it was the first in a three-part series exploring morning, noon and night. And I'm going to leave you with the opening.
Somewhere in the world right now, morning is breaking. Every living thing wakes. At this very moment, someone is greeting a new day. Or maybe it's their first day.
From dust I rise, and out of nothing I awake. These brighter regions which salute mine eyes, a gift from God I take. The earth, the seas, the light, the day, the skies, the sun and stars.
These lines were written in 17th century England by Thomas Traherne. In a series of poems, Traherne blends a fully formed mind with the body of a newborn infant to imagine the sensation of seeing the world around us with new eyes, beginning this very morning. The earth, the seas, the light, the day, the skies, the sun and stars are mine, if those I prize. Imagine if this is the first day, the morning of your life. How would the sky appear to you? And the sun, he asks. In a 17th century lesson in mindfulness, the poet tells us to look again, to begin again, to greet this morning as if it were unknown to us, because, in fact, every morning really is.
From dust I rise, and out of nothing I awake. These brighter